There are a lot of demands for federal assistance dollars currently. Severe droughts have devastated farms and ranches in the lower 48. And in Alaska, Chinook salmon fisheries have declared a disaster. But so far, no money has been appropriated by Congress to help struggling fishermen here. Is there a compromise in the works for disaster dollars? How does an upcoming election affect congressional work? Senator Mark Begich joins us to field questions on these and other topics from Alaskans across the state on Talk of Alaska statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by First National Bank Alaska, offering business solutions to help Alaska's dreams grow for 90 years. On the web at fnbalaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC. And by The Pebble Partnership, developing a comprehensive mine plan that meets Alaska's regulatory requirements while supporting sustainable fisheries in Southwest Alaska. PebblePartnership.com. Alaska Pacific University offers convenient, high-quality, affordable adult undergraduate programs. Applications are due October 19th. Apply at alaskapacific.edu or by calling 564-8248. This message sponsored by APU. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
Hello and good morning. Welcome to Talk of Alaska. I'm Lori Townsend, sitting in for a vacationing Steve Heimel. And joining me in the studio is Senator Mark Begich. Good morning, Senator.
Good morning. How are you?
Good. Thank you for being here. You kind of slid into the hot seat right there,
on time. If you don't live on the edge, you're taking up too much space.
That's right.
You know?
And also joining us on the phone is APRN's D.C. correspondent, Washington, D.C. correspondent, Peter Granitz. Peter, are you there?
Good morning to both of you.
Yes.
Good morning. And we want to talk, there's a lot of ground to cover today, and of course there's going to be a lot of Alaskans who will have questions as well, and I wanted to let people know that you can join us outside of the Anchorage area across the state. You can call us at 1-800-478-8255. That's 1-800-478-8255. And in the local Anchorage area, you can reach us at 550-8422. 550-8422. You can also email us at talk@alaskapublic.org. So as we move into November elections, how much work can we expect Congress to get done during the flurry of campaigning? And Senator Begich is here to answer some questions about what we can expect to see in the next little while. It's kind of a short time. But one of the things I kind of wanted to get right out on the table and talk to you about, Senator, is I know this is called Talk of Alaska, but I want to talk about China. China has, as the Arctic becomes, the prospects for ice-free summers become more possible, and there's more exploration and potential being seen in the Arctic for not only oil and gas, but minerals. Mm-hmm. China is really wanting to get involved in the Arctic. They're spending a lot of money in Greenland. And one of the things that I saw in an article in September in the New York Times was a quote from China's State Oceanic Administration saying that China considers itself a near Arctic state. And the quote was, they are proclaiming that the Arctic is the inherited wealth of all humankind. And that struck me as an interesting statement. They're asking for permanent observer status on the Arctic Council. What are your thoughts about that? Should they be on the Arctic Council? And when? What's your level of concern about them moving into the Arctic?
Well, first off, no. I don't think they should be on the Arctic Council at all. They're not an Arctic nation. Being near Arctic nation, I mean, that's like near beer. It ain't beer. so let's be frank about that. And that is, they're aggressive everywhere in the world. You know, in Africa, they're huge investors in countries in Africa to try to take control of resources down there because that's really what they're about. They may come in with humanitarian kind of comments, as you've just read, but the reality is, and we monitor a lot of work that they're doing in Africa right now, and they're just buying up companies or bringing huge amounts of investment so they can control rare earth, natural resources, for their benefit economically and militarily. And so from the U.S. perspective, the Arctic, we're an Arctic nation. Alaska is the driver of that, obviously. China is not, and I have no interest in seeing them in that. They would like to divide up the Arctic by population base. That's the other part they didn't mention in that article, which, as you can imagine, their view is those resources should be utilized by China in some way. The reality is the Arctic is an incredible opportunity for Alaska, for this country, and for the Arctic nations. And, you know, everything from the rare earth minerals that may be there, the oil and gas that we know is there, the science and technology that can be developed and looked at, the fishing potential, which, of course, as you know, it's off limits right now. You know, and as you look at the kind of the shopping list of transportation corridors that are up there, it really is an incredible opportunity for us as Alaskans, for this country. And China will take its wealth and try to buy their way into it. And I think we have an important role to play here to make sure that the Arctic nations benefit from the Arctic as we see the benefit there. And so they're going to be aggressive.
It does seem like a potentially aggressive statement, the inherited wealth of all humankind. It sort of feels like that's maybe a line in the sand. What are your thoughts about just that statement itself?
No. So, it's the same. You know, if their view, they're trying to find any method or statement they can make to claim some element of the Arctic. Now, is the knowledge of the Arctic, the science and what we might discover in the Arctic, that information valuable to the world? Of course it is. No question about that. You know, we don't know what we're going to find in those kind of climates underneath the ice, for example, what kind of organisms and other things and science that we may discover. That will become, that knowledge obviously would become, you know, out in the world. But the resources and the territorial waters, those are the countries that are the Arctic nations. Mm-hmm. So I get what they're saying. They want everything they can possibly get their hands on. They're a natural resource consumer, big time. They have huge needs. Their growth rates are pretty excessive in the sense of what they have to manage, and they don't have the resources to manage it. And so they got to buy it, take it, or in this case, claim it. And I think in our role, we have to be very careful. You know, is China an important trading partner? Sure they are. But it doesn't mean because we trade with them for business purposes that they should be able to just take what they want. And in this case, that statement, you know, they hide behind the statement. It sounds a little harsh on them, but I'll tell you, this has been their move on multiple fronts, both in the Arctic, as I said, in Africa. They have done some unbelievable things in Africa to control the resources. In Afghanistan, they're trying to control the mineral resources there. And yet, unless I miss something, they weren't in there helping create freedom for the communities throughout Afghanistan. But now that some stabilization is going on and the Taliban is disbanded to a certain degree and Al-Qaeda is out of there, that they want now to take the resources. And it's just an amazing thing. So
1-800-478-8255 is the number statewide to join our conversation today with Senator Mark Begich. Also locally in Anchorage, 550-8422. So, Peter, you might want to jump in here. I think that the next natural question is how, well, first, before we move on to the issue of the law of the sea, how will that play out as far as this Arctic Council concern? Is there a vote pending on their status, or is this just something that they're trying to get done?
Yeah, they're trying to get done. It takes, obviously, the council to agree, and the U.S. isn't going to agree. So,
does it have to, do all the nations have to agree?
Yeah. Okay. And so I wish them the best. You know, it's designed for the benefit of the Arctic nations. And I get what they're saying. I mean, they, as you know, we deal with them in a lot of other areas that we have challenges when it comes to our fishing, for example, and some of the takings that occur in the high seas. And, you know, of course, they claim they have nothing to do with it. But the reality is, we got to be very careful with our resources and how we're and who we're partnered with. And so I think, you know, you mentioned the law of the sea, you know, that hopefully, you know, we won't do anything in Congress between now and election day. But after election, we'll have several items. We'll be dealing with the Bush tax cuts, the Medicare fix, the tax extender bill, the budget, in the sense of what we do with automatic budget cuts. And the law of the sea is in that list. The challenge is the law of the sea will consume a week to 2 weeks on the floor, which is hard to get that kind of time when you're dealing with all the budgetary issues. But the Law of the Sea is critical for us. And anyone who, and I know I get the calls once in a while that somehow it's a UN takeover and all that. That's just not accurate. I mean, think about this. First, the Alaska legislature supports the Law of the Sea. So that's a pretty broad spectrum of folks who serve in the Alaska legislature, as you know. The military, the business community, the environmental community, the governments all support the Law of the Sea. The delegation, Don Young, Lisa Murkowski, and I support the Law of the Sea. So this isn't some UN takeover. It is about our own sovereignty and controlling our destiny in the Arctic. And we are doing things now, but and we're implementing what we believe would be the treaty. But the problem is you can't be at the table if there are land disputes or jurisdictional areas. And that's part of the Law of the Sea, is to ensure. The other thing the Law of the Sea will do, and this is one area probably we can tweak a little bit, and that's how the revenue streams work in non-land that you currently have possession of or outer continental shelf. But the business community desperately needs this treaty resolved because they're not going to explore, maybe scientifically or natural resource extraction, until they know the rules of the game. Because they don't want to be putting activity into the Arctic and then find out, you know, 2 years, 3 years later, oh, by the way, actually what we told you you could do and that tax rate we had of, you know, we'll just hypothetically say 5%, now it's 50%. Well, they need certainty. And Law of the Sea creates that certainty in the business community. It also creates an opportunity for us on scientific research to partner in a cooperative way. We're doing some stuff now on oil spill technology among the Arctic nations, a cooperative agreement outside of the Law of the Sea. But the Law of the Sea is an important jurisdictional effort and treaty that we need. And every president, you know, it's not a Democrat issue. It's not a Republican issue. You know, some people say, well, this is another UN Democrat kind of. No, Bush supported it. Obama supports it. The delegation supports it. As I said, all these other groups support it.
Why is it so hard to get this done then?
Well, you know, I think the system in Washington is broken. I said this when I ran. I said this is one of the biggest challenges is not that policy. Like I just met with the visitor industry, the ATIA, and talked to them about the Travel Promotion Act, which we passed in a bipartisan way. There was a lot of good reasons it passed, and it's going to help us promote the state and the country to the world market, which is important for us. It's good business for Alaska. And so when we don't have things pass, and that one did pass, things just start slowing down, and then you get into these big kind of policy issues, and what you have is one or two senators, and literally one or two senators who say, well, you know, I think it's a UN takeover. And I've heard them on the floor. They rant and rave about this, how the, you know, the global control of our country, and we're all going to be wearing UN blue hats, and all, and it's like they're off their rocker. It's just not, it's not accurate. And I say
Senator Begich, there's 34 who oppose it right now.
Well, there's 34 who signed a letter, and I will say this, that, you know, the politics of today for some of those folks in the minority is let's be hard right because that makes them survive a primary. That's what that's all about. That's people who want to have some credentials on the marker that say to them, to their primary constituency, that, hey, look, I am part of the hard Tea Party, far right extreme. Yes, I am. I support this because we don't want the UN take, because it's a great statement, you know, we don't want the UN taking over things. Okay, hey, who I don't, you know, it's the United States. But those 34, I think if you look at them, there's some out there that are fairly soft. But I understand why that was done, because the people who were driving that letter, you know, basically gave them ultimatums. And that is, you sign the letter or we're going to get someone who's primarying you. Now, people can argue if that's true or not. That's what happened. Now, people can say, no, I signed it because I believe that the UN. No, a chunk of those people have been pro Law of the Sea before, but Law of the Sea. But now these primaries, Republican primaries and Democrat primaries, but in this case, Republican primaries, they're afraid they'll get primaried and lose their primary because they're not radical enough.
That leads into another issue, and that's about the issue of what the Senate's going to look like, not, you know, come November 13th, but come January 20th. Are you worried about how few moderates are going to be left?
The death of moderates.
Yeah, there's actually, I want to say the Daily News might have had an article yesterday, maybe it was today, on the moderates. And, you know, you worry about that quite a bit because you cannot, I don't care if it's local government, state government, federal government, your business, your personal life. You can't manage to the extremes on either side, because when you do that, then you're unable to get things moving forward because you're unable. And it doesn't mean you give up your principles. You know, people say, well, then you're giving up your principles. No. You know, I can sit there in a corner and argue all I want about the 100% I want. But if nothing happens, then I got zero. So I actually did argue my principles away by doing that. But if I can get 80%, then I'm moving down the right road. And I think the makeup of the Senate, and I may be off here, but I think it's fairly, people are fairly comfortable with this scenario. And I think the Senate will probably stay in control of Democrats based on what we're seeing. But also there's some moderates that are probably going to win too. Joe Donnelly in Indiana, he's a supporter of Anwar. He's a Democrat. He's ahead in the polls there. Heidi Heitkamp in North Dakota, another Democrat, but good on energy issues. If they win, it actually gives a little resurgence to, at least in the Democratic group, the moderates. On the Republican side, there is a serious problem with moderates surviving because they get primaried out. And that is Lugar, who in Indiana, who was a very good senator, a Republican I worked with, rational, you know, could sit down. You don't always agree, but you can kind of keep moving. He not only got beat, he just got cremated. I mean, it's 20-some points he lost by because he wasn't conservative enough. I don't know what that means anymore. Some people I know who are listening probably say, well, I'll tell you what it means. It means no government, less taxes, or no taxes. Well, yeah, that's not real, but that's a great statement. But, you know, you got to pay for roads, got to pay for schools, got to pay for the military. Someone pays for that.
If the Senate does break down, say, 51-49 with the Democrats still in control, are you prepared to be courted by the GOP on major pieces of legislation?
I'm courted now. What are you talking about? The last 4 years.
Say taxes. I mean, maybe the next Ben Nelson.
They've talked to me quite a bit about taxes. They've talked to me about energy issues, as you can imagine. Second Amendment rights, which I'm a strong supporter of. That's why I'm sitting on a bill now, on a tax reform bill with Senator Coates, who's a Republican, and Senator Wyden. It's a total tax reform, lowers corporate rate down to about 25%, flattens the rates overall to 3 rates rather than 6. I've been in multiple meetings on budgetary issues. I just did a piece with Senator Ayotte, who's a Republican, on wasteful spending over at the Pentagon that we teamed up on. Senator Coburn, who's a very conservative Republican from Oklahoma, and I are on a piece of legislation on getting rid of surplus property in the federal government. So we are seeked out. You know, we're already on the list because also we're willing to figure out how to get through these issues, and I'm willing to go work Democrats to bring them on board at the same time. And so we'll work with whoever has Alaska's interest in mind. If they don't have Alaska's interest in mind, they need to talk to someone else. But if they have Alaska interest in mind, then I'm willing to talk with them. And I do. And I just gave you kind of a collection of kind of moderate Republicans to very, very conservative. I'm on a bill right now with Rand Paul on auditing the feds. The only Democrat out of 30-some folks on there, I'm the only Democrat on there because I do believe that Fed should be audited. But at the same time, I'm on a bill with Bernie Sanders about throwing out this whole Citizens United thing because I think it's corruptive and corrosive to our political process.
You're listening to Talk of Alaska. I'm Lori Townsend sitting in for Steve Heimel, and we have Senator Mark Begich in the studio with us, and also Peter Granitz, APRN's Washington, D.C. correspondent, is on the line. You can join our conversation by calling 1-800-478-8255. That's in the outlying areas, and in Anchorage, 550-8422. We're going to take some calls, but first I want to get to this email that we have from James, and James is talking about sea ice change, erosion, ocean acidification caused partially by carbon emissions. James wants to know if you support a carbon tax or fee to reduce carbon emissions.
Yeah. I want to make one comment. You know, I'm sitting here while you were reading that. I remember the days where they'd come in with a sheet of paper.
Yeah.
You remember that? Where they'd hold
it
up.
Wasn't that long ago.
I know, and they'd hold it up on that window there, and they'd say, caller Fred wants to talk about, and you'd be like trying to read it. So it's so amazing. I was watching this interaction here.
Yeah, we're all modern now.
I know, it's so tech heavy. I think the reality of a carbon tax or a cap and trade or any of that, that's not going to happen at this point. And here's the way I've looked at this issue of climate change, because that's kind of his fundamental question: is sea ice melting climate change, you know, non-renewable resources and what the emissions are they're putting out into the air. Here's the way I've approached this, and I come from, after being mayor, where we implement a lot of things to lower our energy costs. When we did that, we also, as you can imagine, conserving energy, which is a low-hanging fruit, ensures that you end up with lower emissions, which in turn helps our climate issues. The goal of making sure we have renewable energy is a critical one. In this state, we got a goal by 2025 to be at 50% renewable energy. We are hardcore supporters of that. We're trying to change a law in Washington, D.C. right now to make sure hydropower is considered renewable. This is the most amazing thing, and it's all because of some old issues in Washington, northwestern United States. We've worked out the language. We have no opposition to it at this point. Senator Murkowski and I are now just trying to find the right bill to put it on that will help accelerate our renewable energy. I believe in the mileage standards and what we've done. Now, I know there's great debate over that, but when you can double up on the mileage standards for vehicles, it's incredible how much energy you will save, which means, again, less emissions. When we ensure that more power generation plants, and can get into gas instead of coal, that's an energy, you know, clearly saving emissions. The work we did with Tote Shipping, who now, instead of just keeping on diesel and doing scrubbers, they decided we're going to go to liquefied natural gas as our source of energy to move goods. And they're doing it because it makes economic sense, despite what some people say. They say, oh my God, rates are going to... No, they're doing it because it makes economic sense, and the environment will be helped by that. The other work as chair of the Oceans Committee with regards to fisheries on acidification of waters, warming of water, our trends are changing, and it's impacting our fisheries to a certain extent. We lack the full knowledge of that. We've introduced a bill specifically around Arctic science very recently. I've put it in. Senator Murkowski has joined me on it, as well as some of the departments see a value here, putting more resources into understanding the impacts to our oceans. Because as you know, in Alaska, fishing is big business. 60% of all live caught fish in this country come from Alaska. So there's a lot of pieces to this equation of how you kind of churn and go after the issues of emissions. Anyone who thinks we're not going to have renewable or non-renewable energies, that's just not going to happen. How we can minimize that is our target.
Well, I want to talk more about fisheries here in just a moment, but first let's take a call from Kodiak. Vicki is in Kodiak, and she has a question about the military buildup. Vicki, are you there?
I am. Good morning.
Good morning.
Yeah, Senator Begich.
Yes.
I just want to talk about the passive aggressiveness towards China.
You know? Oh, we're losing you, Vicki. Hold your head still if you're on a cell phone.
Oh, there she is.
I'm very nervous now.
Yeah, well, let's hope she pulled over while she was driving.
No kidding.
I know the area in Kodiak where the bad cell site is, so I have a feeling.
That's unfortunate.
You know, Kodiak is a great example of renewable energy success. Between their windmills and their hydro, they're almost going to be at 90%, and we're working now with the Kodiak Coast Guard base to do biofuels.
I wonder if she has a concern about, you know, as her statement said, their military buildup. She mentioned China, right. Called it passive aggressive. She may have concerns about what kind of buildup may be coming for Kodiak and the missile situation.
Sure. I think the first thing is, by 2014, we're going to have combat troops out of Afghanistan, period. And I'm not interested in extending that. Their military is becoming much more able to manage themselves. And plus, we got to bring those folks back here, and we got to put those monies, those dollars back in rebuilding this country. And that's what we have to do. Second, there is a concern that people have, and Kodiak is one piece in the sense of the missile testing site, which will continue to probably expand, to be very frank with you, because there's private missile issues in the sense of satellite launches that they want to utilize that facility for, because it has commercial value. As you just saw, SpaceX, which is a private company, just launched another successful, at this point, satellite and payload to the space station. That is the kind of thing that I think Kodiak gets into, because there's a lot of commercial activity that we can benefit from, and it's great jobs. But the big concern that we're starting to hear is, okay, you're going to deal with all these budget cuts, but people want to take the Defense Department kind of off the table. Well, that's unacceptable. Everyone has to be at the table. This problem that we're dealing with, the $16 trillion debt, didn't happen overnight, didn't happen over Democrats or Republicans. It's everybody. And so we got to deal with this, and it means everything has to be at the table. And the issue I mentioned that Senator Ayotte and I did was on Pentagon waste. This was a $400 million single project that the military does not want. But because of the way they're interpreting the contract, they got to finish it for a project they're never going to use. So I think there's a lot of opportunity to control those expenditures.
Senator, I want to ask you about that in a second, but could I just, you talked about winding down the war in Afghanistan, a couple things on that. Do you think the Afghan National Army, the ANA, is able to take over right now?
Probably by 2014 they will be, but you know, here's what's going to happen. The minute they take over, there's going to be challenges by the opposition. That's just think about our country. When we won the Revolutionary War, if you recall, just a few decades later, Britain came back for number two, and they, you know, attacked the capital. And then, oh, by the way, a few years later, a few more decades, we had a civil war. It didn't happen overnight. So you're going to see, more than likely, a spike in activity as we roll out and as they take over. But at some point, they have to manage their own affairs. We cannot be in there holding their hand forever. We can't afford it. We've lost a lot of lives, and it's time to bring that resource and those people back to the country here to take care of our problems, rebuild our country, and help pay down this deficit.
And we're seeing an increase in so-called green-on-blue killings, I believe is what people are labeling it, where you see members of the Afghan National Army attacking and killing U.S. Members of the military. Is that a sign that maybe we shouldn't wait till 2014, that we should pull them out now, that we're no longer welcome?
Well, I think, you know, the first question, it's, you know, they did some reevaluation of their force recently, and several were purged out of it. But if there's a plan to come out earlier, that doesn't bother me one darn bit, because I'll tell you, I think there's never going to be the perfect time. That's the point that people say, well, what's the perfect time? The perfect time is when you're gone, and then everyone has to take responsibility. And at some point, the Afghan government, who plays footsies with the folks on both sides of the equation, it's time for them to step up and say, this is what we're going to do. They took out Karzai, and I've said this publicly before, and this always gets me in trouble. I usually get a call from the State Department at some point here. But we had a good governor working in the Helmand district who was supportive of a lot of reforms. Great stuff going on. And actually very well liked in the district. Karzai removed him, because he wasn't a yes man to Karzai. That's a problem here that we have to recognize. The only way that gets changed is when the people of Afghanistan say, enough. We can keep doing it, but there needs to be some control and responsibility on their part. And it's a tough decision, because we know the minute we're out with combat troops, there will be more fatalities. We know that. But we've lost thousands. And it is time that Afghanistan take the lead on their own future and their own destiny. And it means Karzai cannot play footsies with everyone. He has to actually stand tall. Pardon me?
Does he have to?
The people of Afghanistan have to make that decision. But I will say that they need to recognize. I mean, again, the governor in the Helmand district was doing great things. I have been in that district twice, and when I read that, I thought I was just amazed, because I thought, here's some inroads they're having, and why would you, and you'll see it. They'll have some claim that he did something wrong, So.
We're going to take a short break here, and when we come back, there's a lot of calls, lots of folks from around the state that would like to ask Senator Mark Begich a few questions, and we'll take those calls and also emails as we get them in. And I also want to start off after the break, Senator, with a discussion about the fisheries disaster and what we can expect coming in that regard as Talk of Alaska continues statewide.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from
BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska. Breastfeeding leads to healthy babies and healthier mothers. Women who breastfeed are less likely to get breast or ovarian cancer,
and babies get fewer ear infections, score higher on IQ tests, and are less likely to be obese as adults. The road to lifelong health begins with breastfeeding. Call 907-465-3100 if you have questions about breastfeeding. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services WIC program, an equal opportunity employer.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. I'm Lori Townsend. And today we have Senator Mark Begich in the studio with us. We're talking about federal issues for Alaska. And of course, there's a lot of them to discuss. You can join our conversation. We have a lot of callers on the line that we'll get to here in a moment. But if you'd like to also call in, you can join us statewide at 1-800-478-8255. That's 1-800-478-8255. In the Anchorage area, it's 550-8422. 550-8422. You can also email us, talk@alaskapublic.org. Senator Begich, I'd like to get the status of the fisheries disaster monies and what can people in these beleaguered areas in Alaska who have suffered greatly because of poor runs and closures, what can they expect for help and when will that be?
Well, the first thing is, as you know, we've gone through the procedures now where it's been declared an emergency. That's the first step. The federal government has recognized that, which is also very important because they could have not recognized it as an emergency disaster, not only for the YK district, which is important, but also the Cook Inlet region mm-hmm. with our king salmon. Now, the next step is you got to get some resource money to it, and that's our challenge. Now, the good news is, oddly enough, there's never any good news with disasters, but because there was a disaster declared in Massachusetts or New England states, as well as in the Gulf on two other species, we have some allies on disaster relief money. And that's very important because usually we're hanging out by ourselves and we're trying to explain, you know, this. And as you know, not only put that disaster aside, I was just in Kenai yesterday looking at the flood damage there.
Yes.
That's another one that's all tallied up. And if the governor decides that's a disaster declaration need from FEMA, then we're going to have to fight that battle and get some revenues for that. But in regards to fishing, we do have some allies. So now the next stage is, as we get back in November, we've already started to talk to Senator Kerry's office, and they found, you know, because they also see the same thing. Okay, they need allies.
Mm-hmm.
So we're anxious to team up with all three of the regions, the two others and us, and then go forward and see if we can get an appropriation. If we can get some resource, some money, then the goal is to get that out to the communities in a variety of ways based on what the communities are requiring or asking for, and that's still yet to be fully developed. But the goal first is we got to get some money through a disaster bill, and we're not there yet, but we're now getting some colleagues that have similar situations.
Do you think it'll be tough given the fiscal climate and the
yes.
fact that there are so many disasters in the lower 48
yeah.
as well? Crops,
well, there's
cattle.
An unbelievable drought in the lower
yes.
48. And those that may know people in the lower 48 or family or friends, and you're talking to them, I mean, it's not like a little drought, it's a disaster.
So how does Alaska compare in you know?
Well, it varies. You know, I was in North Dakota recently to go see their flood damage. You know, as I saw Alaska's flood damage, which is a different, it's interesting. You know, we have flood damage and they have flood damage, but it's kind of different. Even though it was water, you know, their houses, literally whole communities were underwater. I mean, it's unbelievable. Then you go to our communities and community buildings were gone, you know, because the kind of flooding that occurred. So, we have allies, and that's really so. I think people understand disaster relief is part of the requirement of the federal government to assist in. And so I think we just got to find our allies and see if we can get some dollars. So we compete like everyone else, but everyone's felt the disaster. So this is one time where I do see bipartisan people coming together because it's not about me, it's not about you, it's about people who literally lost everything.
Right.
I mean, I walked in this one home and just literally everything they owned was gone.
I'd like to get to some calls here. Peter, did you have something to add?
Just a clarification that you're working with Senator Kerry's office. I know that there's, and I think Maine is also one of the states
yes.
that have the disaster request. How would this come? Where would the money, first of all, how much money do you think the entire package would be? And would this be something that comes on its own, or would it be part of, an authorization for something else, for an overall disaster package?
Yeah, Peter, I think it would be, it could have three avenues of how this resource could be applied. One, it might be part of an appropriation bill, which we have to move forward. It might be part of the farm bill when it gets finally resolved, because, as you know, the farm bill passed the Senate, but it's over in the House right now, stalled, and maybe there's a way to kind of create a compromise and add a disaster piece on there, or a single bill. I don't think a single bill is likely, but a farm bill or an appropriation attachment might be the higher end of it. And I'm one of these that believe this is one, you know, people always want to know what's the pay for. Well, disasters are one of these things. I don't have a problem in not having to pay for, because disasters happen. And you
right.
can't sit around and twiddle your thumbs and go, okay, who do we cut to take care of that problem? You got to deal with it.
It's hard to plan for that.
It's hard to plan for that. And this is one area where I do not have. Matter of fact, I have supported the balanced budget amendment, but I've also made caveats. Disasters and act of war.
Well, let's take some calls now and get some other Alaskans on the line here. We're going to hear now from Jason in Copper Valley. Jason, you have a question about state responsibility? Remember, we're talking to our federal representative here. Jason, are you there?
Yes, exactly. He is a member of the state, I believe, before a member of the Senate. A couple of quick, interesting points you touched upon. I'd first like to... You mentioned what's the definition of a conservative, and I would like to feel a conservative puts his family in his community and his fellow citizens first, and looks out for their security, for food, and civil defense in the form of police and military and militia and organization. That extends itself towards responsible fiscal planning, and extends itself continuing towards responsible tariffing. You bring up China, which is really interesting.
Do you have a question?
The Northwest Passage is opening, and they do a lot of business with the rest of the world. And so having a clean and responsible legislation to manage that excess of commerce going past our ports and our fellow neighbors, we don't want spills. And the other, China's really interesting because it begs the development of those ports and putting our soldiers to work, developing new infrastructure to, I don't care why the planet's changing, it is. And if it's getting warmer, if it's getting colder, we'll deal with it. It's something to look forward to. You touched a great deal on fisheries, and the Chinese are very aggressive fishers, and they do a lot of very destructive fishing tactics, and I felt very strongly if there was military force applied to regulate and have responsible fisheries in the deep seas and bycatch, because protein's being wasted. This brings us up to the Bristol Bay and what the state could do to promote programs for value added. We can have, they like salt fish. We can make salt fish. But what is the state doing to help itself? Are there programs to, right now, throw up a bunch of high tunnels in Delta, heat them with biomass fuel, and start producing a winter agriculture?
It okay, Jason,
crazy.
You're all over. Do you have a question? Do you have a
I
question
know,
that
I'm
you can ask?
Place.
Yes, you are.
I want to come back to the base question is where, what kind of financial institutions can you start in resolving using tax funds for state programs so we can help ourselves and i.e. help our other neighbors in other parts of the world?
Thank you.
Well, thanks. Let me first say the way you described a conservative was the way I would describe an Alaskan. I mean, that's who we are, the way that description. So I maybe don't see it in the political view of how you read it, but I see it from a pure Alaskan perspective. Second, in regards to what the federal government can do or the state government can do. I think there's a lot of, for example, we introduced a piece of legislation with the shrimpers from New Orleans or Louisiana and the lobster guys from Maine and talking about seafood marketing, where it's private sector combined with the public sector to market our food product, not only to a domestic market, which is still in great low demand, but yet we sell a lot of it, but to an international market. We think that's an important role, and it's actually modeled a lot of what we do here in Alaska with our Seafood Marketing Institute. It's taking that to a national level because, as anyone knows, fish product is seafood product is an incredible nutritional meal that we need to have more people eating. It needs to be more on the dinner table, not just here in the United States, but across this country. So that's one area. We've also, you're absolutely right about some of the damage that's done by some of the illegal fishing that goes on. I call them pirate fishermen. These are people who steal our fish or destroy our fish beds. And my view is very simple, and that is these folks need to be dealt with in the harshest possible way. And some of you might remember, I've also suggested that their ships be sunk to the bottom of the ocean after we've coursed, so no one calls on this. Take out all the hazardous waste. Don't be calling me on that. But once you clean it, sink it, and be done with it. Because you want to send a pretty strong message that this is unacceptable for us.
We're going to take another call now. This is Herman in Aniak who has a question about this. I love shows like this because we're all over the map with topics, and that's kind of fun. It moves along quickly. Herman has a question from Aniak about low-cost energy options, and I know that that's such a big issue in rural Alaska. Mm-hmm. Herman, are you with us?
Yeah. Good morning, Senator. Thanks for being on the air to hearing from Alaskans. Both Don Young and Senator Murkowski both talk about in order to create the jobs in Alaska and lower we need lower energy costs. Excuse me. You know, right now they have all this liquefied natural gas up North Slope. You know, and too bad they couldn't ship that out like in propane, like 500-gallon tank or 300-gallon tanks. You know, it's all downriver and get that out to rural Alaska. You know, imagine we'd be able to heat our home, we'd be able to cook with that propane, we'd be able to dry our clothes and even provide electricity. And so these 400 could even be converted to propane. And if you put some of that money aside, you know, for renewable energy like timber, I work for Soil and Water Conservation District, and most of the timber on here, they're over 100 years old, they're falling over, it's just there for the taking. And the land around here is really fertile. But we need a cheap source of energy. What can you do to support getting some of that cheap energy to us? And also a couple other things about ANWR. Why don't they open that and create a refinery so we can have cheap gas? It doesn't make sense. We have all this oil and gas, and we're just having a tough time out here. And one more thing, I don't know if, you know, we hear about this federal disaster for salmon. They should really look into them trawlers and what's going on in Bering Sea, because a lot of our fish are coming, not only King Salmon, but coho are coming back small, because there's something going on out in the ocean with the food. Maybe there's too many hatcheries putting out too many fish, but they really need to do something. And that pebble, I know they're talking about putting a bullet line out to Alaska with Donlin, you know, but a lot of people are concerned about these mines with the tailings pond. There's an answer to that. Why don't they process the ore somewhere else? That way they'll have their jobs, they'll have a goal, but we wouldn't have the tailing pond. But maybe you could give some answers.
Thank you, Herman. You've raised a lot of interesting topics here. Thank you very much.
Good stuff. Let me just kind of walk through them very quickly here. First off, I can tell you the work we're doing. We have a piece of legislation pending that Senator Inouye from Hawaii, myself, and some others have supported, which goes after these high seas intercepts and these illegal fishing that goes on. Along with that, we have, as I mentioned, some other legislation that's pending regarding understanding our fisheries a little bit better. What's happening? Our trawler is a part of it. It's bycatch part of it. Is the warming of the water, acidification, all these pieces of the equation we have to better understand. We don't put enough resources. And I want to literally give a shout out to the legislature who put $3 million to the study of acidification of Alaska waters. They really stepped up to the plate, and it was because of the legislature that decided this was an important priority. So I thank them for that. That helps us team up with them from NOAA and other organizations from the federal end. In regards to low energy, absolutely, this is the biggest challenge we have, and there's a lot of great ideas out there. I know the mayor of Fairbanks right now is busy trying to figure out how to move propane or gas, liquefied natural gas, from the North Slope to Fairbanks. If he's successful with that project, that will also open the door, I believe, to other ideas of how to move LNG or propane from the North Slope to remote areas. And I think that's a huge challenge, but I think he has some great ideas there. There's another idea, which actually Don Young has talked about, some others have talked about, which I'm very intrigued by. Why not create a power plant on the North Slope with our gas up there and run power lines coming down from the North Slope to areas, which makes a lot of sense, big transmission lines. So all that, and that's actually being studied now. Wind energy in rural Alaska is becoming more and more prominent, and we're supporting that through the Recovery Act that we passed a couple of years ago. The only one in the delegation that supported it, but it's going to renewable energies. Fire Island, for example, those windmills are supported by the Recovery Act money. We're seeing some others throughout. Biomass, huge opportunity for us. I saw it in Tanana, Fort Yukon, down in Juneau, seeing the Sitka Coast Guard base about to change to biomass. Cheaper, more readily available, and taking these, as he called these trees that are just kind of falling, how to maximize the use out of them.
Mm-hmm. Let's take Edward has a question about resources, and I am going to let you tell us where you are, Edward, because our phone screener typed a word up there that I can't pronounce. So, Edward, where are you, first of all?
Motel.
Well, what's your question?
I have a comment or question. Since we're talking about the resources and in the future, that guy who we elected said he will be benefited. And how I see it nowadays, if the state could build, the United States could build their own oil and gas refinery here in Alaska. Since we get our resources from Alaska, and we end up paying more. For heat recovery, and since the high cost of fuel is impacting Alaska, if the congressmen or senators talk about if they could build a gas and oil refinery, so they could in financial way, it will benefit Alaska more than Washington or whoever.
It's hard to understand, isn't it, Edward, that we pay such high prices for energy here and there's such a resource here.
Yeah.
So,
the issue, this is interesting, and there's a good article in Business Monthly this week. It talks about the history of how we kind of got our oil taxes and so forth. But part of the equation was royalty oil. This is oil we take in kind for, instead of a cash payment, we take oil. The reason we did that was because we wanted to make sure there's a refinery here to refine our own product. The problem now is it used to be, and this refinery up in Fairbanks, Flint Hills, is powered by diesel. In the old days, diesel was cheap. So you could produce with cheap energy refined products. Now diesel is very expensive. So now it's very costly to refine that product. So one of the ideas, and I think this is a great idea, again, the mayor of the Fairbanks borough is working on it. They can get gas to that refinery. Then you can lower the cost of refinery, therefore lowering the cost overall. Second, we're working with the military because here's one of the things that refinery does. That refinery produces jet fuel. Critical. We are the fourth largest jet fuel storage facility for the military in the world. 26 million gallons up in Fairbanks. They draw directly with a pipeline from the refinery right to their facility. We started to have a discussion with the leadership of the Pentagon. I sit on the Armed Services Committee, so we see these guys all the time about what they like is redundant. You know, if you just have one refinery, they get a little nervous. They'd rather have two. And what I've explained to them is the way we get the two is we got to have gas to help lower the cost. Well, just as they paid for that pipeline that moves from Flint Hills over to the military base, what I'm arguing to them, for national security reasons, they have to help us find a better fuel source to power up those refineries. Now, that's going to help the military, but the end result is it helps Alaskans because we had a lower cost. So we're starting to have this discussion now.
We're going to take one more short break, and then we'll take more calls. You can join us as well as Talk of Alaska continues statewide.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from the Federal Aviation Administration setting standards for the operation of aircraft in airports. FAA.gov/go/FlyAlaska or toll free at 1-866-357-4704.
Increasing energy efficiency is an easy way to reduce energy consumption and save money. The Alaska Housing Finance Corporation now offers financing to publicly owned facilities to make improvements to increase energy efficiency. Find out more about how their loan program works and if there are public buildings in your community that are a good fit for the Alaska Energy Efficiency Revolving Loan Program at ahfc.us. This message sponsored by AHFC.
one 800 478 8255 or 550-8422 is the number to call. If you can get a call in quickly, because we have a lot to get through in the next very few moments before the end of Talk of Alaska today. I'm Lori Townsend. My guest is Senator Mark Begich. We also have Peter Granitz on the phone from Washington, D.C., who hasn't had a chance to get on here lately. Sorry, Peter, but we are going to take some more calls.
He's sending you an email.
he's going to get in here somehow. We're going to hear now from George in Anchorage, who has a question about Senate Bill 557. George?
Yes, good morning, and thank you for taking my call. Good morning, Senator Begich.
Yes.
Senate Bill 557 refers to charitable donations from retirement accounts. Basically, at the end of 2011, the ability to make a charitable donation directly from a retirement account expired. Mm-hmm. Now, as an old person, I'm 76 years old, if I want to make a charitable donation, and I guarantee you I am not one of the top 1%. If I want to make a charitable donation from my retirement account, I have to pull that money out, pay income tax on it, then make the donation, and then I take a small write-off on my income tax, which is nowhere as near what the taxes that I paid. Senate Bill 557 from Senator Schumer in New York basically reenacts the charitable rollover permanently. It has a few other benefits also, including the total amount that you can make and so forth. And it makes it permanent so that this is not a year-by-year, gee, should we do it, gee, should we not kind of thing. Given all of the confusion and all of the discussion about taxes and everything else, do you think there's any chance that Senate, first of all, yes, I'm going to ask you to please support 557. I've talked to you, your office staff before, and I've talked to Senator Murkowski about this. I ask you, please support it. But do you think there's any realistic chance that that's going to pass this year?
Yeah, first, let me just say this and to my staff that's listening. Yes, I'll support it. Second, this may be one of those that we add into a broader package on what they call tax extender bills. I can't answer that yet until after the elections because we've got to see kind of the climate, but there will be a tax extender bill of some sort, maybe a small one. The question, will they consider this critical enough to put in right away? But I think the idea is a good idea, and I like the idea of making it permanent so we don't have to have this back and forth create certainty. So I am supportive of that.
Thank you very much.
Senator, I'm going to move to an email call or question here. This is from David in Anchorage, and he wants to know if you are supportive of the mandatory budget cuts to take place on January 1st.
I voted for it when we did the package deal almost a year and a half ago. If Congress, and I mean Congress collectively, that means Senate and House, can't come up with a budget proposal, then those automatic cuts will go into play. And that's the consequences. And, you know, what I'm surprised about right now is a lot of folks want to get out from underneath that. And they just want to kick the can down the road. The reason we voted for that, it was tough medicine. And the reason we did that is to hold our feet to the fire to resolve these budget issues. But let me make it very clear that you can't solve this budget problem by just cutting. You're going to have to cut. You're going to have to do revenues. And then you're going to have to invest. You're going to have to invest in education, energy, and infrastructure, all three together. No single one by themselves. So if we're unable to do a deal, the cuts come, and they're going to be painful.
We're going to take another caller here quick in the last few moments that we have. This is Tom in Homer. Tom, you have a question about fossil fuel?
Yes, I do. Thank you for taking my call. I'd I just encourage the senator to read Alcohol Can Be a Gas by David Bloom and encourage him the rest of the Congress to read it, and also the oil companies. It points out alternative fuels and the danger of drilling in the Arctic.
I'll be happy to take a look at it. Let me also say that to encourage my colleagues to read something is always a hard challenge, but I can only take responsibility for myself. I will also, tonight in Anchorage, if I can just mention, it's 5:30 tonight. We're having a town hall meeting at Wendler Middle School. We'd encourage people to participate, and hopefully more like these questions will be asked and give a chance for a little exchange.
Let's try and squeeze in one more quick caller. This is Matt in Fairbanks, who has a question about state compact. Matt, are you there? Matt? I guess Matt isn't.
That's a quick question.
He is no longer there. Peter, did you want to get one more question in very quickly in the last couple of minutes?
I did. We've been talking about tax extenders and things like that. There is talk in town. I'm sure you saw this morning Senator Schumer basically said, you know, Republicans, be warned, we're not going to budge an inch in the lame duck on either separating the cuts and taxes or, you know, we will not budge on cutting if you're not willing to raise taxes. Is that a way to start?
Well, as I just said, I don't care what side of the equation you're on, you have to do all three. You cannot solve this problem by saying all we're going to do is cut the budget, or all we're going to do is raise taxes, or all we're going to do is do it by growth. You have to do all three. So, and I've said that over and over again. So he may be more direct in how he's approaching it. Of course, you know, he's from New York, has a little more abrupt way of approaching things at times. But, you know, my view would be, and it's been consistent publicly and privately, that the reality is all three of these issues have to be done at the same time. You cannot do one without the other two, or two without the one. And that's just the way it is. And people who are not saying that are in denial, and they're not being truthful to the American people. They are really hiding behind a bumper sticker campaign slogan, and that's not going to cut it to save this country from what it's facing right now. And so all three, I wish you would add to the third. You know, if he says cuts in revenue, you better add growth, because we have to invest in education, energy, and infrastructure. That's a long-term benefit for this country. So all three is my book.
Well, we are just about at the end of the show, and it's been a lively conversation. Thank you so much, Senator Mark Begich, for being with us today. You'll be at, did you say Wendler?
Wendler tonight, 5:30. It's a town hall meeting. Look forward to having people out there.
Thank you so much for being here. Thank you, Peter Granitz, APRN's D.C. correspondent, for being on the line. Thank you to our callers. Join us next week. Charles Woolforth will be the guest host for Talk of Alaska next week.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by Providence Imaging Center, with Doctors Scott Nespinski and Christopher Reed, providing interpretations of imaging studies with a focus on musculoskeletal radiology, provimaging.com. And by ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Every day, over 4,000 infants and toddlers go to sleep in child care programs across Alaska in unsafe cribs. The Alaska Community Foundation is partnering with THREAD to replace unsafe cribs in licensed child care programs across Alaska with new safe cribs. To help, donate today, and the Alaska Community Foundation will provide a one-to-one match of your donation. To donate, visit alaskacf.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Community Foundation. This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.